We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Listeners, we are joined by one of my favorite returning guests this week. But before we bring him back in, I wanted to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. They've got new courses all the time. Some of their new ones include a beginner-oriented course from a friend of the pod, Grandmaster Jesse Cry. Fiona Steele Anthony has a new course out. Fabiano Caruana, for those of you working on advanced aspects of your game, obviously legendary player and opening theoretician, plus much more. So be sure to check out those courses as well as my recommendations, as well as just periodically taking a look around to see what is new from our friends at Chessable.com. Now, our guest this week is someone that I interviewed back in 2019. It is an entertaining interview. It holds up well. I was reviewing it yesterday. He is a grandmaster, a FIDE senior trainer, and a FIDE arbiter. He's won various tournaments, participated in the FIDE World Cup. As a trainer, he does a lot of work with U.S. chess youth world teams. He's been a resident at the St. Louis Chess Club, resident GM, I should say. He's been a top 50 player in the U.S., but he's actually based these days in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And I am pleased to welcome back to the program Grandmaster Robert Hungoski. Welcome, Robert.
Hey, man. Thanks. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Good to catch up. No pressure, but I LOL'd a couple times when I was reviewing our interview yesterday. So pressure's on to entertain again. You ready?
I'm good to go.
Okay, excellent. Well, you were just telling me some stories before we hit record that we will get to later. But first, I wanted to hear a bit more about your rise up the American chess scene. Because in our first interview, I found it somewhat interesting that you were emphatic that you have no chess talent. And, you know, for a lot of people listening, to hear a grandmaster say that, they think that I think it's called gaslighting these days. They feel like they're being gaslighted if a grandmaster is telling them that they have no talent. But to your credit, you did detail how hard you worked, especially as you got serious about chess in your high school years. You described 6 to 7 hour days. And you described briefly in our interview that you were born one day before Hikaru Nakamura, who you said was stronger than everyone in your age group. But I'm curious, Robert, who else were your contemporaries and who else made you feel untalented in those days?
Oh, man, it was rough. It was rough growing up. I still maintain that, that theory. But they talk a lot about Magnus's generation, you know, like the, what is it, 93? What year was he born in? But it's like
90 or 91, I think.
91, but, maybe. But it's ridiculous. Like the amount of elite players that were born that year is insane. But I would argue that my year, 1987 and I think 86, 87. I think Magnus is 90, 91. was also impressive. I mean, when I went to World Youth events, you had like Andreykin, Vitugov, Lekwang Liam, a bunch of like Chinese guys, Wang Yue was there. Just guys that there's like at least 20 guys that are 2700 now. So, and they were already really good, like, you know, 2600, high 25. So, you know, when you're struggling at the IM level and, you know, you go see these guys play, you're like, oh, okay. You know, they're just seeing different things. Like they, it's like a whole class.
And yeah. And in thinking about sort of when you were born, it strikes me that you were kind of like America was really a chess backwater, say 1980 to the early 1990s. And then it got an influx of Soviet emigres. And obviously when Rex Sinfield came along, the culture really changed. But in thinking about when you were coming up, it strikes me that you were kind of at the tail end of that. Like, do you think that it was a disadvantage in those days to be from the United States?
Oh man, I don't know. My first big tournament, you know, that I went to and felt like, oh, you know, this is really cool. Like I could really get into this was a Pan American that was held in Argentina in 2001. And the U.S. sent a huge delegation. And I was part of it. And it had like Joel Benjamin, Jen Shahadi. And it was like hundreds and hundreds of kids from, you know, all the way from Canada down to Argentina, you know, representing every country. And I was like, wow, this is something else. So my experience in the beginning was pretty positive. You know, I was like, oh, I can be a part of this. You know, I'm cool. Then, it didn't seem unattainable to play like in a U.S. championship final at that time. It does now, right? I mean,
right.
It's like an elite tournament. So in that sense, it's kind of a pity, because it's just so far that you're like, oh, okay, that's just not going to happen. You still have like the U.S. Open spot, you know, that I've played for many years. You know, there is that sort of Rocky Balboa opportunity. But overall, I think it's a good thing. You know, maybe it didn't benefit me, but I think it's definitely going to like raise the level of, you know, American chess for sure.
Yeah, it's on an impressive trajectory for sure. And for listeners who did not hear our prior interview, Robert did talk about how at his level, Robert, forgive me for calling you an average GM. Obviously, that's most of us would kill to be average GMs. But he was saying how he has to be opportunistic about the tournaments he plays. He plays like the continental tournaments to try to qualify for the World Cup, which he has done. And he goes out of his way often to play the U.S. Open because, as Robert just said, that is one of the few backdoor ways into the U.S. championship if you're just not one of the top 10 rated players in the United States. But Robert, correct me if I'm wrong, you didn't make it to the U.S. Open this year, right?
No. It's getting hard to carve out that time and the logistics. So I'm taking my foot off the gas in the U.S. Open for now.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't just a one-off. I know you have a kid. So, and obviously it's a long way from Buenos Aires. So,
yeah.
Totally understandable. And hearing you discuss the U.S. chess culture, I can't help but think of the Indian chess culture, which of course we're recording this not long after the FIDE Grand Swiss concluded. Obviously it's, you know, the gains they've been making were already well known, but it just seems like the level just keeps being raised. What do you think about the rise of the Indian players and particularly the recent success of Vidit and Vaishali?
One of the really cool things that I got to do was going as Argentina's Olympic team coach to the Olympia that was held in India last year. I'd never been to India before, and it was like crossing a portal to another dimension. Like, you know, like it was the first time that I traveled to a place and felt like I was, you know, I'd gone to Europe, I'd gone to, you know, all places in Latin America, but it always felt like you were sort of more or less in the same culture, right? And now it was like my first incursion into like Asian you know, customs and that kind of thing. And it was mind blowing. I mean, at the hotel where I was staying at, they were offering free yoga lessons. So I did yoga for the first time. I'm addicted to yoga now. Do it.
Oh, nice.
I love it.
Good for you.
Completely changed my life. So, you know, when we got there, the whole city was a grinding to a halt for this event. The chess is held in a very high position there. We would be asked for photos, autographs, all the time. And people would come to the playing hall in, you know, busloads to witness it. It reminds you of the golden era of chess. You know, you see those old photos, like maybe on a Facebook group or page, where you see like Spassky or Fischer playing and there's like 200 people surrounding them. It was that kind of thing. So I think that has a lot to do with it. One of the reasons why, you know, I don't consider myself a talented player, but I think, you know, I made a lot of progress was because I was very passionate about it. I would just pour myself into it and there was just no limit. And that's, you know, you get that energy with what they did for that Olympiad. That was my first Olympiad that I went to, and grandmasters that I know that have like 15 Olympiads on them, by far the best ever.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. And of course you have like Prime Minister Modi tweeting to congratulate Vita and Vaishali after the event. And the news just broke that they're providing financial support for all of the Indian candidates qualifiers. So yeah, I mean, it seems like obviously it's one of these things where you can get sort of like a flywheel or a virtuous cycle where the success builds on the success and, you know, good news for India, but the rest of the world's going to need to watch out in the next 10 years or so.
I read an interview that Ramesh gave, maybe, I don't know if it was last year, but I just got my hands on it. And it was really interesting. I mean, I'd like to hear more about what's going on in that side of the world. You don't hear a lot about Indian coaches. Well, now you do because the players are so good. But most of the time, it's the players themselves that put out like a course, you know, or a video or something like that. But in China also, I mean, who are the well-known coaches in China? Do you know any names?
I don't. Yeah. India, I know better.
Yeah.
But China, I don't.
But, you know, there's a lot going on in China, too. So you're like, okay, who's doing all that work?
Yeah.
And it doesn't really cross over so much. It gets sort of caught in this, you know, cultural net. But one of the things you know, that I wanted to talk to you about was these seminars that I'm organizing, these coaching seminars for FIDE. And the idea is to try to get people from all these different backgrounds to talk about coaching and what's going on. Try to piece together all the pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah. So tell me more about the seminars.
What do you know about FIDE America?
I know a lot about America, and I know a decent amount about FIDE, but I don't feel like I know that much about FIDE America.
So FIDE America is like a bridge between FIDE and all the different federations, you know, in the American continent, right? So it's kind of an umbrella that's in charge of organizing stuff like the Continental, the Pan Ams, you know, all the youth categories, the zonal events as well, right? And on top of that, they also create these seminars. These are called FIDE Trainer Seminars, that if you're interested in pursuing a career in coaching and you want to get, you know, a coaching title, you know, you have five different titles, then you have to take the seminar, sort of take an exam, fill out an application, a resume, and all that kind of stuff. So there's a big process to be done. And this is the first step, you could say.
And okay.
The only real requirement is that you be 18 years or older and have a FIDE ID.
Okay. And I'm guessing it costs a bit of money?
Yeah. It costs 200 euros. And,
okay.
That includes it's 8 2-hour lectures, and we have a pretty interesting roster. It has all the recorded lectures that you can later download, as well as supplemental materials that each lecturer might have. But our roster this year, it's going to be the first English seminar that I'm in charge of. So this is all kind of a new experience for me too. And I'm trying to think of like the people that I would like to listen talk about coaching. And for this seminar, we got Shirov, Bologan, Chaparinov, Kaidanov, who's was on your podcast recently, which I heard.
Yeah.
Good friend of mine. And Boykov, Miguel Iliescas from Spain, Stefanova from Bulgaria, and myself. So we're each going to be talking about, you know, stuff that we've been working on.
That's awesome. And it's $200 for all 16 hours or $200 for each 8 hour?
No, for the whole thing.
That's a steal.
I mean, I think it's a good value. I mean, you'll get a lot, and it's a tough course. I mean, there's an exam and there's a form that, you know, sort of a resume template that you have to fill out and put in everything you've ever done related to chess coaching. So,
but there's no lower bound reading requirement.
No, not at all.
Okay.
I actually did a seminar in Spanish in October where we had 90 participants and we had them ranging from 1,200 to there were three GMs in the seminar too. So
as students.
Yeah.
Or
as.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. And can you give a little preview? So you said you're going to be one of the lecturers. Like what sort of stuff will you be talking about, Robert?
I'm going to be talking about game preparation. Right? So I got a lot of experience working for the US team at World and Pan American Youth events. And usually we wouldn't have a lot of time to prepare. Maybe you would have 15, 20 minute sessions with each kid for each round, if you were lucky, right? If you had a double round, then you might have to cut down in half. So you needed to give useful information fast. Right. So you had to get down to the core. Okay. Let's put a game plan, assume this is going to happen. And then, you know, how do you react against that? So that gets tied in with openings as well. So, you know, you need to have an arsenal that you can choose from. And then, you know, the whole process of how to apply it, what tools you have, you know, how to use databases, engines. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with Yada database.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. So that's an online database that's very good and kept quite current, up to date.
Huh. How's that spelled?
Y-O-T-T-A.
Okay. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
So is this, would you consider this like a chess-based rival / substitute or supplement or what?
Well, I think these days, Lee Chess is chess-based competition, right?
Yeah.
You can do a lot of, at least the most fundamental things that you would need chess-based for. Now you can do it on Lee Chess, whereas before you had no other choice. Chessbase still has a lot of interesting functions, right? Very specific, but that Lee Chess doesn't have. But you could have databases and analyze your games in Lee Chess without needing Chessbase at all, right? Which is kind of interesting.
What do you tell your students? Like, I mean, I imagine most of your students are young and pretty talented. Mm-hmm. If they ask about getting Chessbase versus Lee Chess studies, what do you advise?
I try to be a minimalist. Right. So when I start a lesson, I do all my lessons on Lee Chess. So, you know, I'll create a study. Each chapter will be a lesson and then supplemental material games, positions. You can just create, you know, separate chapters as positions. So I try to use as few tools as possible. And also you have the engine sort of embedded in Lee Chess. And now you have this amazing Lee Chess database. Have you seen this thing?
You mean where you can sort by rating level or?
I don't know. You can put a position and it has a tab. You can access,
oh, yeah.
You know, a regular database, then the Lee Chess database. So all the games ever played on Lee Chess, you can sort of navigate those.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It has huge statistical value, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And then you can actually search for individual players. So it's amazing what they're doing and it's all free. So.
Yeah. Shout out to Lee Chess. Amazing.
Yeah.
And bringing it back to the trainer seminar. So you mentioned Grandmaster Iliescas. Correct me if I'm wrong, but he has like a big chess institute in Spain, right?
Yeah, he's kind of an institution in himself. He's like, I would say, Spanish-speaking world's Yasser. So he's, well, he also was Kramnik's second for many years, right? And was, I think, top 30 in the world. Member of Spain's Olympic team.
Not a bad resume.
No. I mean, this guy has, he's got all the right titles.
So what did he, do one of the Spanish lectures already took place?
He was.
And what did he talk about?
He actually showed some very interesting functions in ChessBase that he uses to compile material, right? So I was, I usually talk with them a little bit before they start, introduce them, and also after when they finish. And, you know, Miguel shows this, does a lecture about how to study pawn structures. And I asked him, well, how do you, let's say you want to study this structure, how do you go about assembling the material, right, for that? Like, how do you choose games? And you're like, you see a game and you're like, oh, this is relevant, you know, for this and why. So there he started using this this ChessBase function to sort of filter by structure, right? And then he kind of keeps whittling it down with filters until he gets, you know, maybe 20, 30 games. He plays over them very fast and, you know, you start developing a pretty good intuition for picking up games. So it's that kind of stuff. I think, you know, if you're a chess coach, if you want to be a chess coach, it's the kind of stuff that the nitty gritty work behind the scenes that you need to do.
Lots more from Grandmaster Robert Hungoski after the break. We'll be right back. And we are back. And you mentioned that there's sort of like five tiers of eventual titles and that this one works on the first tier. Mm-hmm. So if someone signs up for it, like, and they're done, they survive the 16 hours.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
Well, you have to take an exam. Like, we don't award titles, right? We just offer the seminar. FIDE does all the titles. So you have to apply for your title like you would for your IM or GM title, right? And it gets approved at FIDE Congress and it goes through all of that. So we walk you through the process. We help you fill out the application and we get it submitted to FIDE. And then it's sort of in FIDE's hands. But the only title that you can't get by a seminar is FIDE Senior Trainer. That's that sound you hear in the background. Is a very popular thing they do in Argentina, where a guy with a megaphone on his truck says he's willing to buy your refrigerator.
Wow, yeah. That is crazy.
Anyway, I got sidetracked. So
yeah,
what was I saying?
You were discussing the certification and saying that the
so,
senior
senior trainer, that's by resume only. So you just fill out a form and you send it directly to FIDE if you feel like you have the qualifications, if you meet the requirements for FIDE Senior Trainer. But
okay.
It's pretty tough. It's a tough title.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that it would be tough. And we're recording this on November 15th. Robert, this will likely be out on November 28th. And what were the dates for the seminars again?
The registration deadline is December 5th. And it starts on the 8th. And last through the 10th, 8th through 10th.
Okay. And as you said, if you can't make it live, you can take it asynchronously, as they now call it, I think.
Yeah, all the lectures get recorded and they get put up on a drive so that all the participants can access them as soon as the lecture is done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, sounds good. I'm interested myself. I assume that's on a weekend. I didn't check the calendar.
It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay. It's funny, but I'm like, the certification is, I just want to see the lectures, you know, the certification, yeah. I could take or leave, you know.
I mean, I think, you know, the roster is impressive. So, you know, you're going to get quality lectures, elite lectures. And then it also helps pave the way for maybe a door will open in the future, right?
Yeah.
And you'll have this title and it'll be helpful.
Sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
But it does go up to FIDE Trainer, which is the highest title that you can get through this process. And that's also a pretty tough title to get.
Okay.
Yeah.
And which title are you?
I'm FIDE Senior Trainer.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's all thanks to my students, because one of the requirements is you have to have coached somebody that won a world championship, right? Of any age group, but world championship. And I was just coming off this amazing run at the World Cadets in Brazil that was held, I think, in 2018. And one of my students in the under eight category got the gold. And it
Wow.
Yeah, it was intense. It was great.
And in our prior interview, you talked about how, like, at these world events, like, you're assigned students, basically, but they're not necessarily your students away from those events. Like you mentioned, coaching a top talent that Mezgin Amanov normally worked with in our prior interview.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm talking about.
That's who it was. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So it could be either way. Like, could Mezgin also, based on the same student winning, have been given the senior trainer title?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
and Rob, go ahead.
You know, I was working with him through that period in the tournament, but you know, a lot of the times when you go to these events, you're getting students that work with you throughout the year, that travel to the event, and then they request you to coach them during the event. So there is priority given to people that already work together, that want to keep working together during the event. So, you know, sometimes, like in this case, you'll get a student that has a regular coach that's not with them at that event, and then you have to, you know, sort of take them, you know, walk them through that, you know, experience.
Okay. And doing so, I know you coach a lot of teams like that. You're traveling to a fair amount of events, maybe not as many as you used to. But what's your day to day like, Robert? Are you mostly doing online lessons?
I was doing a lot of online lessons, and I'm trying to cut back. Now I'm trying to get involved in other projects. You know, like directing these seminars is something that's become very interesting for me. I like this idea of, oh, I get to pick my own roster, right, for my coaching squad, right? This is fun. So, you know, I get to talk to people like Shirov and try to convince him.
Did it take convincing, or was he like, let's do it?
He's a cool guy. I got to meet him a couple of times. I got to play him a few years ago. He was really cool about it. So
how'd the game go?
I met him in Brazil at this tournament where we were in charge of taking care of him. Me and another good friend of, I just met him there, but there's this GM from Uruguay named Andy Rodriguez. They're kind of the same age. So Andy, you know, he used to play with Shirov in, you know, under 20, under 18 categories. And they're like, you know, just show him around Brazil. I'm sure, you know, he doesn't get into any rough neighborhoods. So Shirov wanted to go to the beach. And we went there like at 9 a.m. I'm very pale. So I'm always, I have like the most potent sunscreen on me. You know, I see Alexei there, who's even more pale than I am. You know, he's from Latvia. So I'm like, you know, you should probably get in on this, put some of this on. You know, the Brazilian sun is pretty hot. He's like, I don't need this. I'm like, okay.
No prophylaxis, huh?
No, man. He was just all in. And he falls asleep and wakes up a couple hours later. And, you know, he's just red like a tomato. And, you know, he's like, I gotta get out of here. And he goes back to his hotel. And, you know, he wasn't getting to the round. And the organizer's getting worried. And he's looking at us like, what'd you do with him? Like, where is he? And then this towering figure, you know, just moving from side to side, barely able to like move. He was so sunburnt.
That turned How up. Tall is he?
Oh man, he's a lot taller than me, and I'm 6'2".
Wow.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
So he had a rough tournament. But anyway, we got along. He's a very humble guy. He was number two in the world. And one of the greatest, you know, tacticians ever. So it's going to be interesting to see what he's going to talk about. He actually just got off the Isle of Man tournament. And, you know, I asked him, is there anything you want to talk about? And he said, yeah, some psychological aspects of competition. that I experienced at Isle of Man. So he's going to be talking about that tournament.
Man, that sounds great.
Yeah.
What's it like? Like, have you done, I mean, you played him, so you probably did. Did you do postmortems or like analyze with him?
Yeah. It was an interesting game. It was interesting because I actually had a shot, right? Shiro blundered a pawn in the opening and that kind of leveled things out. And then I got this, one of the most winning positions I've ever gotten. And Shiro found some pretty interesting defensive resources, and the game ended in a draw. And afterwards, he started talking to me about stuff. I didn't understand anything. Like all the variations he was saying, I couldn't really follow. But I think he was just like so upset when he blundered that pawn that it kind of spiraled.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because obviously that's an amazing result, like, you know, to draw a player who was number two in the world, but it sounds like he sort of spotted you a pawn. So,
yeah, you know, I get this, I see Ivanchuk play sometimes and you get this aura of like greatness. Like, you don't know like what these guys are thinking about during a game. And it's not the same thing you're thinking about.
Have you interacted with Ivanchuk?
I've seen him play many times, and one time he asked me what time it was.
What'd you say?
I didn't have a watch. And it's like useless to me.
And is there, so who are the most, we've talked offline. You're friendly with Ulf Andersen. So you've got some good Ulf stories and you've analyzed with him. Who are the most impressive people you've analyzed with? So, I mean, we've already got Shirov and Ulf, so I don't know who else you're choosing from as a pool, but I'm just curious.
Granda is very interesting to analyze with. Julio Granda from Peru.
I don't know
if you're familiar with him.
Of course, yeah.
Another genius level chess player. I think his peak rating was 2699. So it's kind of a shame he never broke that 2700 barrier, but you know, he would just trade blows with, you know, Topalov and all these guys during the 80s and 90s. So he's an absolute legend in Latin America. And also you get that sense of him just seeing things that you don't see. With Andy Rodriguez, we always, you know, kind of wonder at Julio. And he told me of a game that Julio saved against him that was unreal. So I think the game was Rodriguez Granda, and Granda finds this ridiculous maneuver to sacrifice an exchange like four moves down the line to get a less losing position, but where now white has to like play very accurately. It was just like this brilliant, like he was just reading the Matrix, you know? So I dig that. Like when I see somebody do that, I'm like, okay, that's cool.
And Granda, I know he's still playing some events in Charlotte. Do you know where is he based in Atlanta? Where's he based these days?
Oh, I don't know. I knew he was living in Spain for a long time. Then he went back to Peru. As far as I knew, he was in Peru.
Okay. Maybe he is. Yeah. I'm not sure. And you being from Connecticut, Robert, I've got to ask you about Hans Niemann. I mean, obviously he's a bit younger, but did you see him like around when he was young, when you were young and he was younger?
Yeah, sure. All right. Like last time we spoke, it was before Niemann's big breakthrough, right?
Before many things with Niemann. Yeah,
sure. I remember Hans. He was the same when he was like 10 years old than he is now. So success has not changed him.
Right.
So he's always very confident, very sure of himself. And I met him, I would see him at tournaments in Connecticut, but the first time that I spoke with him was at a World Open. And he came up to me and asked if we could play a couple of Blitz games. And we did. And then we played in the regular tournament also.
Okay. So he presumably sought you out because you were a grandmaster?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'll tell you the story. It was kind of funny. I think it's funny. So, you know, he must have been like 10 years old at the time.
Right.
And, you know, he comes up to me. I'm sitting there with a buddy of mine that we would always travel to these tournaments with. And, you know, when you're sitting at the board just waiting for the round to start or something, you're just fiddling around with the pieces. And Hans comes up and he's like, let's play a couple of games, he says. You know, he's 10 years old. I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? Say no? I'm like, sure, let's play a couple of games. And, you know, we start playing and he's, you know, intense. It's an intense game. I win the first game. This is like 3 minutes, I think. You know, he arranges the pieces. We play again. I win the second game. He gets really upset. He's like, it's like, for a GM, you're not that good.
That's great.
Yeah. So then we play in the, you know, the regular OTB game, and I beat him also. And, you know, some years went by, and then he got me at the U.S. Open a couple of years ago, and he crushed me. Yeah.
So okay.
He got his vengeance.
And what did you think of the whole cheating story?
I don't know. I think it was just it was hard to watch. You know, it just seemed like how would you say, like a lot of like yellow journalism, not a lot of evidence, everything handled poorly. It seemed like a bit of a circus at times, and then it all just ended. And it was like, oh, we're actually all friends now. Things fine. So, you know, the whole thing was, I thought Hans got a raw deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, he seemed like he was all alone for a while there, you know, like nobody was really stepping up saying, hey, you know, like where was like US Chess? You know, it's like one of our guys, like, where's your evidence? Because they really cut him down at a moment where he was just really soaring.
Yeah.
You know? So I was sad to see that. I wanted to see how far he would go.
Yeah. Well, he's still young. I mean, I agree with you, as I've said many times on the pod, but he's still young. I mean, hopefully the final story has not been told.
Mm-hmm. I hope not. He's still playing very well.
Yeah, it's just so hard, you know, obviously at that level. It's just the competition is so tough. I mean, you would know better than me, but.
Yeah.
And what about.
And I mean, the thing about it is you got to give it every single second you have, right? It's all the time you're thinking about it. So, you know, as you get older, I don't think the limitation is physical, but, you know, you begin to sort of branch out, you know, maybe, you know, family, work, that kind of stuff, and you just can't keep up.
Yeah. Can you recall a moment? I know you describe yourself as late bloomer, no talent, etc., but can you think of a moment where you said,
put that on my like Tinder profile.
Right. but was there a moment where you said you felt like, okay, I'm recalibrating my ambition. You know, I'm taking my foot off the gas in terms of the competitive aspect of chess.
Yeah. The interesting thing about chess is that it has so many different areas that you can explore, right? Aside from just competition, you know, there's coaching, there's publications, you know, there's organizing tournaments, there's, you know, being an arbiter. So if you want to make a career out of chess, I think, you need to make like a mosaic of these things. You know, you need to dip into all of them and explore them, because you don't want to just always be leaning on the same thing over and over again. It gets kind of tedious and boring too.
So when did you make that determination? I mean, I
think it kind of takes, you know, you just start seeing opportunities or doors that open, and you just explore them without really knowing where it's going to go. I mean, you know, with your podcast, it was probably something like that in the beginning. Like, you just thought it would be interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Didn't really have certainty as to, you know, how it would end. But, you know, if you're always just doing stuff, you know, constructive stuff, you know, improving yourself in some way, or, you know, stepping outside of your comfort zone, at some point, all that stuff comes back in a positive way. I mean, you know, it has to, right?
Right. And so out of all the hats that you wear, you know, arbiter, trainer, trainer of trainers, content creator, et cetera, like, do you have a favorite?
Oh, the GM title, of course. I mean, that was blood, sweat, and tears. So, yeah, I put a lot into that.
How many years did you feel like you were, like, actively, I mean, obviously, it's probably, like, a lifetime goal, but, like, Jesse Cry has, like, the stories where he decides he's going for it. Was it, like, a conscious thing that you were going for it, or were you just playing chess and hoping to get there?
I was playing chess and hoping to get there because that's how I got to IM. And I was having a really hard time, like, moving past IM. And that's when I met William Lombardi. And that's when, like, the GM title became, like, oh, no, like, you need to do this. Like,
yeah. And for listeners, Robert told some great stories about how, like, Grandmaster Lombardi, who, of course, legendary American player, contemporary of Fisher's, sort of guided him and helped him push through a plateau. Robert had mentioned in that interview, particularly by focusing on, like, not screwing up the same way twice, if I'm paraphrasing correctly. But Robert, before we were recording, you were also telling a story of a trip you took.
My interviews are going to translate too well in print.
I clipped one of you. I clipped it and put it on Twitter. One of the stories you told, in addition to your trashing my system, people seem to enjoy it. So.
All right.
But you were telling the story to me before we recorded of taking a trip with a memorable trip with Grandmaster Lombardi.
Yeah, this is when I was living in New York. I was studying at CCNY, and I was working as an EMT on the weekends too. And I would meet up with William once a week. We would have dinner. Talk about probably chess was a minor topic. And it was around midterms. And I got a call from him on Tuesday. He's like, I got invited to go to Dresden on Thursday. You want to come with me? And we'll be back Monday. So I'm like, what's going on in Dresden? You know, there's this events for the legends or something like that, where they have an open invitation. They did this every year. I don't know if they're still doing it. I don't think so. But it was an open invitation to any GM over the age of 70 to go with one person, with a plus one, to this weekend where they would have, you know, they would have simuls. They would have, like, these giant chests, you know, like, with people as pieces. And I'm like, okay, let's go. Let's see what's happening there. And I get there, and, you know, Spassky's there, Taimanov is there, Ivkov, all these, you know, absolute legends. So I got to hang out with them for 3 days, and it was spectacular. It was surreal. You know, I would just be riding the bus with Spassky, just talking with him. Lombardi, I remember one time he was always trying to teach me, like, Russian. And, you know, he'd be saying words or pointing at something. And he was trying to say, somebody was smoking a pipe, and he was pointing at the pipe, and he couldn't come up with it. And then Spassky just, like, sneaked up behind him and whispered pipe to him in Russian, which I don't really remember how to say. I don't know if it was Yubka or something like that. But, that was a great trip. And that's when, that's maybe the first trip where I didn't play that I had a great time. And I was like, oh, you don't really need to play.
And that's how you got into to coaching, I guess.
No, I was already coaching, maybe not at full steam, but I already had some students and I had traveled to some tournaments as a coach. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And did Spassky tell any standout stories in your bus rides with him?
I became pretty good friends with his stepson who was there, Alexander. And I remember at night, all the old guys would go to bed and we would just go out on the town.
Nice.
So we would just leave Lombardi and Spassky tucked in and we'd be off. So... no, I don't. I mean, he told some stories, but, you know, some stories I had already heard and he showed some gains. I was kind of like a kid in a candy store. I was just running around talking to everybody.
Amazing. And how was Dresden? How was the nightlife in Dresden?
Unbelievable city, beautiful.
Really?
Lovely. Yeah.
What are your favorite places you've been for chess? I mean, you must have been like everywhere.
I really like Latin America. I spent a lot of time in Brazil. I like Colombia. I would say of Europe, Dresden is probably one of the cities that impressed me the most. But I don't know. I've never been, you know, a lot of chess players think that when they have to become professionals, they need to go tour Europe, you know, or that kind of thing. I never really got that. I don't know if that, you know, had a positive or negative impact on me, but I was never that drawn to it. I mean, Latin America just fascinates me. Anytime I can travel, I just want to pick, you know, a country in Latin America that I haven't been to.
Nice. Yeah.
There, or revisit, you know, places like Brazil or Colombia.
Yeah. You're making me want to travel. Correct me if I'm wrong, your mom is Argentinian, mm-hmm. Dad American. So obviously it makes sense that you speak Spanish and English, but how did you pick up Portuguese?
Oh, it's very similar to Spanish. So if you spend a couple months in Brazil, people are so friendly, they'll teach you right away. Like, you'll pick it up. You'll be talking with people all the time. So just the social interaction, you'll learn it almost by osmosis.
You will. I don't know about me.
Oh, but... well, you should give it a try. Okay. Brazilian people are like the happiest, nicest people I've ever met. So everything is easier there just because the energy is so positive.
That's awesome. When we come back, Robert will share what he learned from his friend, legendary Grandmaster Ulf Andersen, after the break. And we are back. All right, Ulf stories. It's time, Robert. So what was your last interaction with Ulf Andersen?
I invited him to Buenos Aires to celebrate his 70th birthday here. So he came. It was during the pandemic. It was so hard because we had to fill out all these permissions and ask for permissions, fill out all these forms. But we got it. Because Ulf was going to spend it by himself there in that town in Sweden that he lives in, Arboga. If you Google map it, it is in the woods, man. Like, it's out there. So we're like, Ulf, come down here. He's got a bunch of friends here in Argentina. We did this huge 70th birthday party. Had a great time.
Wild party or no?
Not Dresden wild.
Okay.
No, it was Ulf appropriate.
Okay. And what's it like to analyze with him?
Everything's got this nice flow when he's looking at things, right? Like the road is already laid out in front of him, and he's just taking these little baby steps down this path that can't be, you know, you can't stop him. Because his understanding is so deep. It's almost like, well, now he's getting older, right? So, maybe, you know, as you, maybe it doesn't have to do with age as much as it does with not competing so much, that your senses aren't, your sense of danger in some positions maybe is not as sharp as when you're playing tournaments consistently.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, you'll find that your ideas get tripped up along the way, but the idea is good. There's just some kind of tactical nuance. Right. But once that's corrected, then the idea keeps flowing. So with Ulf, it was always like, I'll show him a position and I'll know what the right path is because he'll tell me instantly. Like he never seems to make a bad strategic decision. Right. It he does it naturally. It's like the wrong option is not an option. So it was always very comforting, like knowing, oh, okay, I need to know what to do in this position. I just show it to Ulf and he'll come up with something.
And did you feel like, so obviously on a,
without an engine or anything, right? Then, you know,
yeah.
I would check stuff with the engine later.
Wow. So on a micro level, that's obviously going to be insanely helpful within a given position to be able to just show it to Ulf. But did you feel like he was able to sort of impart big picture chess lessons to you, or did you feel like it was something innate that you know couldn't be passed on that easily?
There's definitely something innate there, because also it happened to me with Lombardi. He was Lombardi could talk for hours and hours and hours, but when it came to explaining chess stuff, he really didn't use words. Like, he would rather just show you. Like, he would just say, let's play this out. Let me beat you 10 times in this position so that you start. So it starts like getting into your head how this works. You know, like he would quote Hans Kamach, who was the manager of the Marshall Chess Club back in the thing in the 50s. He says, you got to think with your fingers, right? You got to get the sort of like the muscle memory, like your fingers should know before your head does, like what the right move is. And I've heard, you know, Magnus and Anand say similar things, you know, like I think Magnus said something like, usually the first move that I see is the move I'll play or the correct move. And then I just spend a little bit of time checking it. So, you know, trusting those first instincts is increasingly important the more time you put into chess, right? Because that's gets stored in your fingers.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. My fingers aren't very strong, unfortunately, but, I love the analogy. And so with your students, Robert, I'm guessing you get some parents asking you, like, what should they be doing aside from their lessons? What's your stock advice for them?
I mean, tactics is still so important. I feel like the way chess is studied is going to be changing a lot. You know, the way chess is played has changed dramatically over the last 10, 15 years. But I feel like maybe the coaching techniques haven't changed that much. Maybe now with Chessable, you start seeing people experimenting with different formats and systems for learning. But, you know, I've been changing how I do lessons, right? The way that I do a lesson now is not the same as 10 or even 2 years ago. Now I like to sort of get in to that, to stay in line with that principle of, you know, how do I help someone think with their fingers? And how do I give them that experience? So I experiment, you know, with the different techniques. Like sometimes, you know, have the student play a game while, you know, share the screen while, you know, we're doing the call and just walk me through. Like during a game, what moments he thinks are key moments? You know, at what point do you feel like you're out of book? At what point do you feel like you lose the thread of the game? And then you go back and you sort of check that. You know, see what instincts were right, which ones were wrong, and, you know, reinforce the good stuff, trying to pluck out the bad. But, you know, there's all these tools online now that when I was, you know, first starting out, there was none of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to get overwhelmed by information.
And for you, do the neural nets play a role in all of this? Like, what's your recommendation for how to interact with engines generally and with our neural nets in particular changing anything?
The engine is a fun toy, but it has sharp edges, right? So you have to be careful how you use it because it can end up killing your creativity, right? You like, for me, that's why it was so important to show Ulf or Lombardi these positions, because they weren't contaminated by the engine. They had all of this old school knowledge that I wanted to tap into and sort of modernize, but I didn't want to contaminate it with the engine. So I would have these positions that I would show them. And then I would check, you know, I would write down all the stuff that we would go over. And then I would just check that with the engine and see, okay, what stuff holds up? Where are the sort of potholes? And, you know, you just try to give it a technological coating, armor, you could say.
So I mean, that's obviously very instructive for how you pursued chess, but what about your students? So do you also, you try to have them not use the engine right away?
Oh, I have the option disabled for the engine.
Okay.
Students. So the idea is to always sort of get you want to be Ulf. Right, you want to be Lombardi. You want to be that guy that that just chess flows for you. And in order to do that, you really need to get inside your head and you know, experience positions and, you know, realize what some of the subtleties are, some of the general patterns are. And that takes time, right? So you don't want to use the engine as a crutch. You want to use it as something that will check what theory, whatever theory you came up with, right? Or assessment you came up with. And then you want to turn it right back off.
Okay.
So that's how I use it. I don't have it on all the time. I think that's terrible, especially like when you're doing game analysis, it's terrible too.
Okay. Good advice there. And we have another question. This one is from supporter of the pod, David Lazarus. Thanks for helping to support Perpetual Chess, David. And he asks, how many black defenses to the main openings you suggest for your students?
I don't know if I really have a number. It depends where the student is at, right? I mean, if it's a competitive student, you got to have at least two, right? And I'm a big fan of practical openings. I'm not one of those guys that's a lifelong Nydorf player. Like I don't think that stuff works anymore. So I just finished doing a course on the Lowenthal Sicilian, which I think is like the greatest.
You got to remind me which Sicilian that is. This is embarrassing.
So, you know, you go e4, c5, knight f3, knight c6, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now after d4, takes, instead of knight f6 or e6 or, you know, all these main moves, the move is e5.
That's not the Kalashnikov, or?
Well, after knight b5, d6 would be the Kalashnikov.
Ah, okay.
If you go a6 and allow the knight to go in.
Oh, yeah, that seems terrible. I've never understood, so that's what you're playing.
That's my jam.
And I remember in the lecture you did for Patreon subs, you're also a fan of this Philidor line with the early queen trade, right?
I'm done with the Philidor. Forget that.
Okay.
Lowenthal now.
You like all the painful openings. That's funny.
Yeah. And in case you have some problems with d4, I got the Chigorin ready to go as well. So d4, yeah, d5, c4, knight, c6.
Wow. All the dodgiest. That's funny.
But easy. It's easy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes sense. And does that advice change based on whether you're working with like a top young talent? I don't know if you work with any adult amateurs, but versus like adult amateurs.
I wouldn't corrupt the youth that way. This is just for, you know, jaded adult learners that want to have time. No, I like these lines because they're not refuted lines, and they're very useful if you're playing in a lot of tournaments, right? So I have a lot of students that play in a lot of tournaments, and they need to avoid preparations, and they need to get preparations in. So I try to comb through lines that enjoy bad reputations, but that aren't as bad as their reputation. That's what I'm looking for, right? I'm looking for something that's going to be underestimated.
Okay.
And these openings that I'm telling you are like a perfect fit.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm starting to play in sort of league games, but basically fit that exact criteria where there's a relatively small pool of players.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just trot out the same stuff, you can be a bit of a stationary target for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, it's good to mix it up and get new things in the roster, right?
If your
brain starts to ossify if you just do the same thing over and over again. I think there's an error in logic that is like, if I play this opening enough times, then I will know it perfectly. Right. And that it doesn't work that way. Actually, after you hit a certain peak, your understanding of it starts to go down because you're almost on autopilot. You're not even thinking about some of the moves anymore. So that's usually time to change. Hmm. Bring in something new. But you'll never
do
anything perfectly.
Right. Do you have any other sort of stock advice for adult amateurs?
Tell me some of the common problems.
Well, everyone, for example, everyone's wondering about how to play against kids now. Everyone's complaining about rating deflation. I don't know if you have any specific advice for, like should adults consciously try to avoid complications against what they may perceive to be younger or sharper players?
I think that's when having these practical openings is good. You need to sort of make sure that they don't get to choose the path, right? Just you have to bring them to your ground and fight on your home ground. I saw this. Do you like tennis?
Yeah.
I saw this great documentary about Boris Becker. I don't know if you saw it.
No.
It's called The World Against Boris Becker. It's phenomenal. You should check it out. And it took me down this Boris Becker rabbit hole, and I started looking at these interviews that he gives on. They're all on YouTube anyway. And I hear this guy talk about tennis, and I think he's talking about chess, right? So he's talking about the serve, right? He's saying, okay, the serve is like, if you have a really good serve, people kind of look down on you in a way, like you're compensating with like a super serve at, you know, maybe a deficiency that you have. Oh, you know, like the best servers are not the best players in the world, right?
If you think of
Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic, they never had the best serve, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, Becker says it's the most important shot in the game. And the opening is the same thing in chess, right? It's the only shot that you control, that you get to sort of decide on what terrain or what area you're going to be focusing on. So that has to be the focus. Just like in tennis, you know, there's a stigma. In chess, it's even more so. Like if you recommend somebody study openings, you're like a bad person. You know, you're like, no, you have to study end games and tactics. And tactics is true, but I mean, the opening is absolutely fundamental. I don't think you can start. You know, you're off on the wrong foot if you mess up the opening. And you can learn a lot of strategy if you really understand the openings that you play.
You're off on the wrong foot if you don't play the Lowenthal.
You are. And you can buy my course here.
You're just kidding, right? But you are working on a course, right?
Yeah. It'll be done any minute now. No, I am done. Like, the material is done. I've actually recorded it, which I thought would be the hard part. But now I have to annotate like a PGN file. And that's killing me. But I'll get
around.
Yeah. Just got to
get Ulf on the case.
Oh man, I wouldn't do that to Ulf. I just have to put the stuff that was on the video more or less into words and writing a paper.
Cool. And you said that's going to be on Modern Chess, that course?
Yeah.
Who was the best blitz player Robert Hungoski ever saw? We will find out after the break. And we are back. All right, couple more questions, Robert. Who is the most impressive blitz player you've ever seen?
I mean, in person or forever?
Let's do both.
Well, I saw Hikaru play in person, and I thought that was pretty special. But just watching Magnus play at the World Blitz and Rapids, it's like I really enjoy watching those tournaments, watching him play. He's just so
cool. Watching online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say Magnus. It's just a pleasure to see him play.
And what about that you've played against?
That I've played against? Probably Hikaru.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't get much better. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And Robert, in our first interview, you talked about being an avid reader. I know for a lot of us, like, our chess reading can fall off as we get older. Are you keeping up with the literature much?
Not at all. I haven't touched the book in years. I do have what to me is like my little chess Bible, which is Kasparian's Domination.
Yeah.
Endgame book.
Yeah, that book gets recommended a lot. I always have to warn readers not to just buy the one on Amazon because it's kind of a crappy version, unfortunately. Yeah. But
you got to get the old hardcover.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I should like set an eBay notification or something and try to get my hands on one.
Yeah.
So are you generally a believer in endgame studies? That for listeners, that's a compilation of endgame studies.
Yeah, I love endgame studies. I like the theme of domination of this book. I don't think it's been explored that much. Like it hasn't been assigned as its own, you know, topic. Usually right. might see as a chapter in a tactics book. But I remember Lombardi told me like it was the essence of the game. Like it was domination. Like all these players that win by submission, you know, it's in their DNA. Like they're just shutting you down piece by piece. You know, that was like the old school way. And I think there's a lot to it. I mean, you know, chess has been modernized, but having that sort of skill, it gives you like a lot of margin, right? Like now they really have to beat you tactically to win the game, because you know that it's not going to be by submission. Like you see those patterns coming a mile away.
Okay, yeah. And you should probably explain that by domination, it's not what someone might think. It's not crushing someone. It's to restricting them.
Yeah, like if you're into, you know, MMA, it would be like a knockout against, you know, winning by submission, right? Mm-hmm. Tactics would be a knockout. Domination would be by submission, you know, getting in zugzwang, just not having to tap out.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, just to explain for listeners. So the book is called the book is called Domination because the studies revolve around positions where like a knight just runs out of squares sort of thing. But yeah, I've got to get the actual book for sure.
To me, probably the best claim, you know, for chess as an art would be that book. That is
okay.
I consider it a work of art. Great book.
And in the period you described in our prior interviews, where you were reading chess 6-7 hours a day during your high school years, like or doing chess, like what else did you do? How else did you immerse yourself?
I mean, chess was it. It was either playing tournaments, studying chess, hanging out with chess players. There wasn't a lot of room for anything else. You know, I would do sports and stuff like that, but it would be with chess buddies. We would just
right.
get together and go, you know, play soccer or something and then go back and study chess. I'm not sure, like, what...
I just meant, like, what were you doing for the study?
Oh, for the... Well, this was way back in the day, right? This is when, you know, the informant would publish, you know, the encyclopedia of chess openings, like, and everybody was waiting for it. All that stuff is gone now. So a lot of the time that I would spend would be maybe like a busy work, you know, like setting up the pieces and playing over games. Like if I'm reading a book, I'm just doing it cover to cover, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just playing over all the games and actually reading the book. If I'm doing puzzles, I'm setting it up on the board. But I remember I was very heavy on openings to a fault. Like I was just obsessed with it. I just felt like I could know it all. And it was fun to me. I just enjoyed doing it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, I think that it's such a long haul that you should just pursue whatever part of the game you enjoy the most. And you know, just get your fill. And of course, you know, be as well-rounded as you can. But for me, it was always openings.
Okay.
And wow. Not tactics. Like, I really didn't like doing tactics.
Hmm. Did that ever change or not really?
No, it got worse.
All right. Well, Robert, always so many fun stories. We should remind people about the FIDE seminars. Anything else before we let you go?
I don't think so. I mean, I'll be back. In the future we'll talk about
that. Would be great. Yeah definitely. So I'll Robert, you can just send me whatever info people need about the seminars in order to submit their applications to attend on December 8th. And and are you taking students, Robert, if anyone wants to learn the Lowenthal?
No
not right now.
No I'm trying to focus on you know, doing the seminars and trying to step away from private coaching and maybe take a step back and see, you know, which directions, you know, this chess thing can go in. Because I've been doing the lessons for the past 10 years or so. So I'm like, okay, I've really explored that. It's interesting. I still do some, I have some students, but I'm trying to, again, take my foot off the gas, not to stop that, but maybe to, you know, go in a different direction.
Okay. Sounds good. All the more reason to have you on the pod again sometime so that people can pick your brain. All right, Robert. Well, thanks. I might sign up for that seminar myself. I've got to give that some thought, but like I said, all the details will be in the show notes, and thanks again for coming on.
Anytime.
Podcast Network.